The Tom Woods Show, episode 2232.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm very glad to be joined today by Benedikt Beckeld, who holds a PhD in philosophy and classical philology from the University of Heidelberg. And he is the author of a very interesting new book from Cornell University Press called Western Self-Contempt. And let's get into the subtitle. First of all, welcome, Benedikt.
Thank you very much.
What is this crazy neologism in your subtitle?
Yes, yeah, so oikophobia and the decline.
Comes from Roger Scruton, apparently.
That's right. Yeah, he coined it in the 90s.
And so what does it mean?
Yeah, so it's oikos, ancient Greek oikos, meaning house or home, and phobia, of course, everybody knows phobia. And so oikophobia is the fear of your own home, in this case, your own cultural home, your own people, your own nation, your own society. And so it's basically the opposite of xenophobia when you fear foreigners.
Right. So the full title of the book is Western Self-Contempt, Oikophobia in the Decline of Civilizations. And it takes us from ancient Greece and Rome all the way up to present-day United States in a fairly short amount of time. Because in the beginning of the book, you lay out very specifically exactly what you are aiming to do and what you're not aiming to do. Mm. So you're able to carry out this huge sweep in not an oppressive number of pages, let's say, for the reader. Right. So, all right. Obviously, this we can all see why this is of current importance, this kind of topic. We can all see that although this is an interesting historical examination, it clearly has present-day applications. We can see that
yes.
In many societies, but we see it not in all societies. We see it in some, but not all. I would venture to guess that if I took a trip to Nigeria, I don't think people in Nigeria would be sitting around thinking about all the ways they've failed the world and failed themselves and all the lousy culture they produced or whatever, the way other countries seem to. So before we get into that, I do want to say something about ancient Greece, but let's speak generally about this. Is it, you talk about historical cycles in the book, does this phenomenon of oikophobia, does it have to manifest itself in every civilization, number one? And number two, when it does manifest itself, what are the preconditions or what does civilization have to go through before we reach this particular stage?
Yeah, so I think the first question can be answered by answering the second question, actually, because if we talk about the prerequisites that a society needs to have in order to become oikophobic, then we see that not every nation will become oikophobic because not every nation has these prerequisites. So basically, the most important prerequisites, as I outline in the book, is that a society should have achieved a measure of wealth and security. That is to say, it shouldn't feel that it's sort of essentially threatened by outside forces. And it should have a pretty open intellectual space where intellectuals can come together and discuss various issues in freedom without fear of repercussions from the government or from the church, whatever, what have you. And if a society does not have those things, then oikophobia cannot develop because it is only when you have safety, when you have security, and when you have intellectual freedom and access to knowledge that people are able to start questioning their own history, and that when their basic necessities have been taken care of, they then have the leisure to start questioning and to start criticizing. And also, it becomes a way of getting ahead of others. If a society is feeling existentially threatened, sort of everyone needs to bandy together in order to preserve themselves. Whereas when you have, as we have in the United States, for example, a feeling that no one really needs to do anything. We're not about to be invaded by Canada or anything like that. Everyone is safe, more or less anyway. And we all live in a space where everyone has leisure. These are prerequisites for self-questioning. And so we see that repeating in history when a society has achieved such a state, which it doesn't have in the beginning, right? It achieves such a state over time through military and economic success. And so we see because of these prerequisites, since not every country has these prerequisites, not every country will become subject to oikophobia. You mentioned Nigeria, right? So I actually talk a little bit about it in the book, just a couple of pages about orcophobia in non-Western countries. When that happens, it's more because of Western influence. So for example, Western colonization and Western influence will lead certain elements of a more tribal community to consider themselves inadequate in comparison. And they'll be seduced by computers and cars and Hollywood stars and all of these things. And so they'll start to look down on their own, quote unquote, more primitive culture as a reaction to that. That's more because of Western interference, so to speak. It's not so much because of their own homegrown intellectual development, whereas Western societies become orcophobic sort of by themselves, by their own development. They're stimulated to orcophobia, of course, through contact with other cultures, because orcophobes, for example, will often consider other cultures, other civilizations to be superior. And so an American orcophobe might look at Asia or parts of Africa and feel that culture is superior to us. So the foreign culture can certainly be a stimulant, but the orcophobia arises more as a result of homegrown intellectual movements. And right now in the news, right, a country like Russia cannot become as orcophobic as the West because you don't have that open intellectual space in Russia that we have here. There are many more limits on freedom. There's a certain sense, I want to almost say, a sense of tribalism a little bit in Russia when one considers oneself superior to other civilizations. And one considers oneself constantly threatened by other civilizations. Not talking about all Russians, obviously, but a sufficiently large segment of the population are like that. And so Russia will never collapse into orcophobia because it's simply too regressed on the civilizational trajectory to reach such a state.
All right, there's a lot there. Now, there's, strictly speaking, there's nothing wrong with, quote, self-questioning, because every individual does that with himself. Anybody who's living a life worth living examines his life and thinks about ways he could improve. And likewise, you could, from a patriotic standpoint, say, I want to point out a problem that I see because it will make the place where I live better if Absolutely. We make this change. But the kinds of self-questioning that you're talking about are really quite corrosive. Mm-hmm. And the thesis of Joseph Schumpeter in his book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, seems to have some overlap with what you're saying. He argues that the wealth that's created by market economies makes possible a leisure intellectual class that can just sit around and not have to engage in manual labor and can sit around and philosophize. And a lot of times this intellectual class resents people who are doing manual work or what they would consider to be beneath them, like a manager at a company or an entrepreneur. This is all very mundane work as far as they're concerned, whereas they are brilliant intellectuals, and yet they're not rewarded on the free market the way these other people are. So they now, because of that free market that gives them the very leisure to sit around and criticize their societies, this creates an intellectual class that is bitter at its own society. And that, as I say, for the first time now, you have a whole class of people that actually can sustain themselves while sitting around doing nothing but criticize where they live. And they're not criticizing it out of a place of, I am deeply in tune with the traditions and folkways of my people, and I just want them to be better. No. It's hatred for anything and everything. So we start with an example. And incidentally, well, actually, before we start with the example, I couldn't help thinking that a lot of what drives this is the pleasure that some people take from positioning themselves as superior to other people. Because the average run of mankind, they love their own country, they love where they grew up, they love the traditions. And so the best way to indicate your superiority over them is to either prefer foreign customs to your own, or to laugh at those who like their own, or to, you give the example of Voltaire being a vegetarian, which is very uncommon in the 18th century. But again, that's a way for Voltaire to say how superior he is to everybody else because they're not morally developed enough to be a vegetarian like him. There's something about this impulse to superiority that leads to such grotesque results.
Yes, absolutely. And that goes hand in hand with the need for safety and the elimination of existential threats, because essentially, as I try to outline in the book, everyone needs an antagonist of some kind for the purpose of self-identification. It might sound like a somewhat cynical take of human nature, but I really think that that's not the whole story, but we do need some sort of antagonistic force or something to struggle against. And when early on in the society, when that is an exterior enemy, then that is the antagonist. I mean, I start the discussion with ancient Greece because they're chronologically the first in this context. And so when the Persians are attacking and burning your own city, there's no time for criticizing your own civilization. You have to bandy together and you have to fight against the Persians. And the Persians fulfill that need, that psychological need of an antagonist when they have been defeated. And in Voltaire's case, he's living at a time in French development when there are constantly wars, of course, going on in Europe at that time, but those wars aren't existential. It's the most powerful country on the continent. When that has been achieved, then you still need some sort of antagonist. And so the new antagonist becomes their own civilization and your own countrymen, and you need to stand out against them in some way or other. Because you said one can distinguish between regular critique and this sort of orcophobic critique that we're talking about. If one is dissatisfied about some particular aspect of one's own society, of course, one can criticize and seek to ameliorate it. But historically speaking, this bleeds over rather quickly as the society develops into this attitude where almost everything that is traditionally connected to one's own society becomes tainted. And that's certainly what happens with Voltaire, because his vegetarianism, as you mentioned, it's one piece of the puzzle. He expresses his dissatisfaction with his own culture in many different ways, not just with its meat eating, but in almost any context one can imagine. Religion, obviously, with the monarchy and so on. And we see that in ancient Greece as well. And so Freud calls it the narcissism of small differences. Another thing I mentioned in the book, which is that essentially the closer someone is to you, culturally or geographically and so on, the greater the need to stand out from that particular person. Yeah. And so it becomes much easier to distinguish yourself from the fellow living down the street than, let's say, from someone living on the other side of the world whom you don't know very much about.
I want to start actually in the more recent times so that people can get a more familiar example of this phenomenon and then apply it to examples like ancient Greece. But before we do that, I want to just say something about the example of France, because France shows, to my mind, where this ultimately goes. This isn't just some cultural curiosity that we might observe. It can have real-world consequences. And we see that in, I think, the most radical phase of the French Revolution, mm-hmm. because they went insane to try to uproot all traces of traditional France. So that meant the calendar, which was not unique to France by any means, but of course it meant the traditional calendar had to be scrapped. Street names had to be renamed. If they had the names of saints in them, they had to be renamed. They guillotined statues of saints. You couldn't pray the rosary. You know, they honored reason instead of God and all this other stuff. It was clearly an attempt to try to remake the whole society over again from scratch. We're going to take the traditional internal boundaries of France, and we're going to replace it with a quote-unquote rational grid style. Everything has to go. And when that happens, when you have a kind of cultural revolution within your society, the oikophobes tend to be quite impatient with people who persist in having affection for the old ways. And so those people are very often, let's say, dispensable in the new order.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the French have always prided themselves on being on the avant-garde and on being at the forefront of whatever cultural development is of the moment. And so it's not surprising that when one wants to find the most extreme expression of some cultural phenomenon, one very often finds it in France. And the French Revolution is an extreme example, but it was identified as orcophobic, not with that word, right? As you mentioned, it's a neologism, but it was identified essentially as orcophobic already at that time. Edmund Burke, for example, says famously in his remarks about the revolution in France that the reason why you revolutionaries did such a mess of it is because you began by hating your own culture. You began by hating everything that belongs to you. And if that's the case, if you tear out the foundation from under your own feet, then inevitably the collapse will follow. Again, you can make fixes in the structure, but if you tear out the foundation completely, then everything will just collapse. And to some extent, of course, that was the stated goal, as you say, of the revolutionaries. They did want everything to collapse, but they didn't realize that building something is much more difficult and takes much more time than just tearing something down. And so the revolution, being as extreme as it was bound to fail, unlike the American Revolution, which obviously took a very different approach.
So even though we see it with our own eyes, nevertheless, sketch for us what the phenomenon of oikophobia looks like in the modern West, and use the United States as a specific example, but you can generalize to the West. How do we observe this in action today?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on where we are. Europe is a bit different from the United States in this regard because orcophobia has become more progressed in Europe. We already actually have an article about this that will hopefully come out soon. Essentially, the United States is the most obvious example right now because the struggle between the orcophobes and the anti-orcophobic reactionaries, if you will, is most pronounced in the United States right now. And so because we have a much broader Overton window of accepted debate here in the United States than is the case in Europe. And so we find all different kinds of extremes in this country. So you have the people, of course, the orcophobes, who are the ones who tear down statues of our founding fathers and who want to, there's so many different expressions, but who want to uproot everything that can be called traditional or that can be called typical, uprooting gender roles, obviously, going very much against all established forms of religion, and so on and so forth, right? The list is long. From the point of view of imagery, probably the tearing down of statues of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and so on are probably the most obvious manifestations of orcophobia, but it takes many forms. You have that, and on the other hand, we have a strong resistance to that as well, obviously from a more conservative direction here in the United States. In Europe, it's more subtle because essentially in Europe, certainly in Western Europe, the orcophobes have already won. And so in Western Europe, almost everyone is agreed, and those who don't agree, they're usually quite quiet about it. Almost everyone is agreed that the old religious traditions are wrong and that there's nothing special about their culture and so on, and that open borders is a good thing and so on. Of course, there is disagreement about these things, but the cultural hegemony of the orcophobes is much stronger in Europe. And so there, the struggle is much more subtle. But you see it in the fact that almost everyone, including quote-unquote conservatives in Europe, would wince at certain opinions that are considered commonplace among conservatives here in the United States, simply because the orcophobic attitude that there's absolutely nothing special about your own culture and that other cultures are unique and special in some way, that has become so widespread in Europe that it's almost unthinkable to question it. Whereas here in the United States, we seem to be a little more orcophobic because the orcophobes here have a much greater resistance to face, and so they become louder in turn. But so those are the expressions of orcophobia, certainly, that we see today.
Hey, folks, quick message from Moll Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. All right, so then let's go back to ancient Greece. Now, obviously, in ancient Greece, there are no blogs, there's no internet, there's no intellectual class speaking 24 hours a day. We don't have everything that was written, even by many of the most prominent people. So obviously, we're not going to see the massive cascade of examples that we see in the United States. And also, I think probably it was milder, considerably milder in ancient Greece than it is today.
Yes.
But let's talk about some examples. And I noticed that between Greece and Rome, and then if we go into the future, we can think about the Enlightenment. If we look at the Stoics and then much later Enlightenment figures, the emphasis on reason, the universality of reason, the worldwide brotherhood of man, that really there's just one people all around the world. There's no reason that believing in those things has to then lead to a kind of mocking condescension toward your own society. But yet, for some reason, that does seem to be where it leads.
Yeah, so what we'd have to distinguish there between philosophical and historical discourse. So purely on a philosophical level, thinking that there should be a brotherhood of man and so on doesn't necessarily lead to orcophobia, although it does necessarily lead to a reduction of one's own cultural particularities. Because as much as we would like to deny it, there are elements of various cultures that cannot coexist in the same space without one having to yield, that are incompatible with one another. One thinks, for example, of gender roles, of the liberation of women, right, in the Western world, and the role of women in certain other parts of the world, those two views are simply incompatible and they cannot coexist in the same space. So if you are going to have a brotherhood of man and the attitude that we're all one people, then necessarily one would either have to struggle against the cultural norms of other civilizations, or one would have to sort of lessen the intensity of one's own culture. And so to some extent, this sort of progressive attitude, this universalist attitude, does to some extent lead to self-critique. And that's on the philosophical level. On the historical level, it most certainly does, because we see how this impulse toward universalism essentially cannot be stopped, right? The human psyche is such, certainly on a mass level, that we are incapable of going up to a particular point and then stopping there and saying, okay, this far and no further. This is a reasonable point at which to stop this particular development. That doesn't happen. Rather, human beings, again, this can take place, not a particular human being, this takes place over generations, but human beings are incapable of stopping at a reasonable point. And so that drive toward universalism does, historically speaking, lead to self-denigration. And we see this, again, repeated since the ancient world. You're right to say that it's not as intense in the ancient world as it is today, and there are several reasons for that. We, for example, in ancient Greece, they didn't have a concept of human rights as we have today, and so there is not this idea that every human being is intrinsically worth the same. That idea actually does start to develop. You mentioned the Stoics. That idea actually does start to develop among the Stoics. But by and large, the sort of classical Greek mentality is not that. But we still see the same sort of transformation, the same trajectory take place in ancient Greece as well. The only thing, they cannot go as far in that direction as we can, because as we mentioned before, the prerequisites are safety and an open intellectual space and egalitarianism and so on. They had those things, but not to the same extent that we have them. And so it stands to reason that our okophobia is more extreme than was ancient Greek okophobia. But the same sort of transformation does take place and is clearly recognizable. But it's more of an elite phenomenon, whereas here now in the modern world, it's become much more of a mass phenomenon. But so,
but yet as a mass phenomenon, though, you still feel like the masses are nevertheless following the elites. I find it highly doubtful that most of these people, if they weren't being led by the nose, by the entertainment world and by certain politicians, it seems to me highly doubtful they ever would have had any of these ideas.
Yeah, no, I think that's a reasonable conjecture. And one, of course, one finds the tendency among regular people to want to rise to the level of the elites by aping their, well, not their customs maybe, but by imitating their views and by adopting their views. I mean, the typical example, of course, is, you know, in college, students admire their professors for their intellects and intelligence and so on. And so they are naturally attracted by the ideas that come from the intellectual elite in the universities. And so then that bleeds down even onto those students who do not become intellectuals themselves, right, who just have a BA and then they exit the academic world and they enter the workforce. They will still have been tainted by those ideas. But it's also that access to information has become much broader. Today, this is also something I talk about in the book. The greater the access to information is, such as through the internet, the greater is the illusion of expertise. The illusion of expertise is something that has happened in the past also, for example, with the printing press, right, that increased access to information in the 1500s greatly. And so that had a similar effect. But essentially, the more access to information for regular people there is, the more self-questioning they will become. And that's why, for example, we don't find it as much in ancient Greece, because when we talk about the Greeks, quote unquote, the Greeks, what we really mean is the elite, the nobility. And so a regular 5th century BC Peloponnesian donkey driver, no, he was not an okophobe. But we can meet regular people today on the street and anywhere in the United States who are okophobes. And so that is a difference.
All right, I have a couple more things. Now, obviously, we're just scratching the surface of your book. So Western Self-Contempt, doesn't it sound like a book you want to read? You should pick it up. Of course, I'll have it linked at tomwoods.com/2232. I'm curious about if you might say something about your chapter on how religion plays into all this, because I can see it going both ways. Mm-hmm. It depends on what religion we're talking about. Are we talking about Christianity before the Enlightenment, basically? Then that's one thing. But if we're talking about Jesus wants you to be nice, Christianity, then I could see that playing a completely different role.
Yes, no, that's true. And you're certainly right. When I talk about religion in the book, I am talking more about the traditional institutions. It's certainly true that, of course, as you know, as I think many people have noticed, there is certainly an okophobic strain now in Christianity as well, in certain parts of Judaism, Reform Judaism as well, for example, not in Orthodox Judaism, that sort of has this kumbaya attitude, right? And Jesus was sort of this friendly hippie and just wants us all to get along. And if that's one's attitude, that of course itself is a universalist attitude. Christianity, of course, is indeed to a considerable extent universalist in the sense that it has universal aspirations, but it still has a very firm moral code. And so that moral code becomes entrenched in the culture. And so if one goes against one's own civilization, one goes against one's own religion as well. The sort of watered down Christianity, especially among the Jesuits, for example, they tend to be on the forefront of this, can certainly encourage okophobia. That's true. So I would say that you say post-Enlightenment Christianity, that's certainly true. And I would say that this is Christianity that has simply become less Christian. And so that's why it's able to be orcophobic. And one sees this in Judaism, right? Judaism that has become less Jewish, if I can call it that, but I think that's a fair assessment, such as Reform Judaism, which I would simply say is less Jewish than Orthodox Judaism, can be orcophobic simply because it has diluted its own core message to such an extent. But the rejection of religion and often atheism, not always outright atheism, but certainly the rejection of traditional religion, that's almost always the first step toward orcophobia. And that goes back all the way to ancient Greece as well. One begins to question God or the gods, and then that will lead later on to a question of the culture as a whole, because the religious nature of a civilization is always such a core part of the civilization. There's no such thing, certainly not in the beginning, as a society that is not religious, right? Every society has an image of the divine in some way. And so that is the first thing that begins to be questioned because it's really the most central part.
You say in the book that you are looking not so much to criticize orcophobia as to understand it. And so you take a kind of, you have a sober prose style and it's not a polemic. But now that your book is finished and you're on the Tom Wood Show, now you can adopt that polemical style. So now I would like to know what the unrestrained Benedict Beckelt thinks about this phenomenon and why it matters to us. What is the practical effect of the fact that this phenomenon appears and reappears in various civilizations? Why should we care?
Yeah, I'm not sure you want the unrestrained version. We'll be here for another hour, but yes. So I say in the book, right, as you correctly say, because the reason I say that in the book, maybe I should say, first of all, is it's not that I mean, I think people who've read the book and you have it as well would see that I'm certainly no friend of orcophobia.
It's obvious.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I say it though, I mean, it's a little bit to cover my bases, but it's also because there are certain manifestations of orcophobia that are a little shadier. And there are certain expressions of orcophobia coming from people whom I otherwise, whose work I very much admire in many other respects. And so, for example, Euripides, right? He's somebody who questions the Greek gods. And so he takes a first step in that direction. But I absolutely love Euripides, right? I think he's a great poet. And so there are many examples like that. So that's why it's more a question of seeking to understand what's going on than to criticize it. But certainly, yeah, you're right that the reason we should care, and obviously I am largely anti-orcophobic, the reason we should care is because when a society becomes overly orcophobic and obsessed with criticizing itself, it becomes incapable of projecting force, either internally or externally. And that might not seem like such a big deal because my generation and a generation or two back, we don't really know what it's like to have to sacrifice for our own society. But that's an anomaly in history. We're very lucky who are alive today. But the fact of the matter is that the world is full of bad actors, unfortunately. And both the United States and the world as a whole, in my opinion, needs the United States to be a strong society. Because if we're not, we're going to get all different kinds of problems developing. And I think we see that right now in the world as well. I mean, I shouldn't maybe go off on too much of a tangent, but for example, the current war in Ukraine is a result of, not entirely, but it's in part, in my opinion, a result of American introspection and of an America that doesn't believe in itself anymore. And the weaker the United States becomes and the less it believes in its own traditions and in its own uniqueness and specialness, the less force it will project into the world and the more hotspots as a result will develop in the world. That's one reason why we should care. There are many other, that's a geopolitical reason, right? There are many other reasons as well. And again, that's not to say that the traditions that we have are completely perfect as they are, but it is to say that the weaker our traditions become, the unhappier we will become. And I think that bears itself out as well. I think young people today are unhappier than young people were a generation or two ago because they don't believe in anything anymore. And I'm not saying this as a religious person. I'm not a religious person myself, but we human beings, we do need something higher to believe in, whether it's something religious, something divine, or something of some other nature, but we do need something beyond ourselves. And the more okophobic we become, the less we have that. And that's another reason why I think okophobia leaves a lot of social misery and geopolitical danger in its wake.
Well, on the other hand, then you should say that you want your enemies to have oikophobia.
Right. Yes.
According to this analysis, right?
Yes. Yeah, to some extent.
Wouldn't you want them to be filled with self-doubt?
That's true. If the Chinese became slightly less nationalistic than they currently are, yes, I do think that would be a good thing. Not necessarily oikophobic, but yes, they should certainly become more self-questioning than they currently are, which goes back to what we said before, right? Self-critique in and of itself is not a bad thing. And I think a case can certainly be made that the Chinese are overly nationalistic and jingoistic, and that that's a danger to the world. So yes, certainly would be happy to share some of our okophobia with them.
Okay. Well, now, obviously, you and I view the geopolitical question quite differently, because I would look at the current situation and say it's an example of American overreach. Mm-hmm. That in fact, yeah, it's true that the established, let's see, I mean, basically every institution, the universities, entertainment, the CEOs of all the major companies, they all think the same way. And they all, you know, they would all think it's quaint and silly to look at a 1950s Superman show that began with truth, justice, and the American way. Yeah. They would laugh at that mockingly, but they have their own substitute America that they believe in deeply.
Right.
And that is working for them as a substitute. And so they're on board for whether it's Ukraine or whatever the regime is asking of them, if it's to fight climate change or whatever the current cause is, that's an America that they like. And I think some of them feel like they've triumphed until Trump made them doubt themselves.
Right.
I think they felt like they had triumphed against that stupid old America that they hated. You know, they've kind of built the lefty America that they always dreamed of.
Well,
you know, and then
I was actually going to express agreement and say, no, I think you're right. But so that's actually when I mentioned before that okophobia appears to be less pronounced in Europe, it is precisely because the okophobes have triumphed. And so they are starting to like their countries more again, but it's that they like the new version of
the
their
new
countries.
Version.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like the French revolutionaries. They were super patriotic after the revolution. They waved the tricolore and everything like this very patriotically because they had changed France into something that they liked. But so I think you're right that certainly this okophobic elite that we're talking about, they do gain a sort of new kind of patriotism of their own. Although I would say, I think maybe you're giving them a little too much credit, because I would say that if the current administration suddenly came out against supporting Ukraine and so on, I think they would find the elite changing their own view pretty quickly. So I think it's more opportunistic.
Quite possibly.
Yeah, I think it's more opportunistic than the genuine love of this new America. But
Oh, that's certainly true. On the other hand, I don't know how far the new Coke went when it came out. It was the 1980s when Coke changed its formula. I don't know if you were living in the U.S. at that time, if you were even alive at that time. Okay, well, that was a big thing in the U.S. And I was one of the only people who actually liked the new Coke. I thought it was better.
Right.
It turned out to be like the worst marketing mistake in history. Right. And before you knew it, the new Coke was off the shelves. Well, I hope you and I can raise a glass of, you know, the old Coke to the prospect of these quote-unquote new societies being swept off the shelf sooner rather than later. We'll drink to that, absolutely. So I want to urge people to check out the book. Again, we've been talking about Western Self-Contempt, Oikophobia in the Decline of Civilizations. You'll find it linked at tomwoods.com/2232. And bear in mind, there are so many more riches in this book that we couldn't even cover in the traditional Tom Woods show allotted time. But Benedict, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.